Hi everyone, welcome back to this week's W3C CCG meeting. So we didn't have one yet last week because of a TPAC, but we'll resume our regular content program starting this week. So this week we're very excited to have Giuseppe and Martin present on NGSI-LD, signing NGSI-LD and also authentication of NGSI-LD. Today and very exciting topic. And before then, just want to quickly go through some administrative stuff. First of all, just a quick reminder on the code of ethics and professional conduct. I just want to make sure that we hold respectful and constructive conversations here. We've been doing that, but let's continue to do that. A quick note on the intellectual property. Anyone can participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributions to any CCG work guidance must be member of the CCG with full IPR agreement signed. So if you have any questions in regards to the agreement or the W3C account, feel free to reach out to any of the CCG co-chairs. A quick call note, these meetings are automatically recorded and transcribed, and we will publish the meeting minutes, audio recordings, and video recordings in the next day or two. And we use GC chat to queue the speaker, so you can type in Q+ to add yourself to the queue, or Q-, and I will be moderating the queue and discussions. All right, just want to take a quick moment for the introductions and reintroductions. So if you're new to the community, or you haven't been active and want to re-engage, feel free to just unmute and introduce yourself. I actually see mostly familiar faces, so move on to the next agenda. Announcements and reminders. So any announcements and or reminders? I know that some of us were in TPAC last week, so any announcements from that? I actually joined one of the sessions, but there's no particular announcement relevant to CCG, so. All right, what about updates to work items? So we'll actually have different people from the different work items to actually provide updates, such as a VCEDU on December 3rd. And then, we'll hold another quarter four review and work item updates on November 19th. So just give you a heads up for what's coming. All right, so last calls for introductions, reintroductions, announcements, reminders, and or work items. All right, that's quick. So just want to get to the main agenda. So this week, again, very excited to have Giuseppe and Martin here. To present on the NGSI-LD, signing NGSI-LD and authentication in NGSI-LD. And by the way, NGSI stands for New Generation Service Interface, I think. But they can go a little bit deeper into NGSI and also how it actually intersects with identity problems that CCG really cares about. So.
Yeah,
I think yeah.
I'll give you a bit of an introduction. I think when we are at the right place. So
great. All right. So without further ado, I think the floor is yours, Giuseppe and Martin.
Okay. Should I share? Try to share first. Okay. Right screen. Okay. It's not quite yet, but almost there. You see my screen?
Yep, perfect.
Okay, so Giuseppe and me, we're both vice chairs of ETSI ISG SIM. I'm a principal standardization engineer at NEC, NEC Laboratories Europe. We are in Heidelberg in Germany. We are the European lab of NEC, the worldwide active Japan-based company. What I will do is try to give you a bit of an introduction to NGS ILD, so you have the general scope, and then Giuseppe will focus on the core topics that we wanted to present and discuss with you regarding signing and authentication. So first, to start with, who are we and what do we do? So we work in ETSI for that standardization. So that's the European Telecommunication Standards Institute. ETSI produces globally applicable standards for information and communications technologies. It's one of the officially recognized European standards organizations, the others being CEN and CENELEC. And we are an industry specification group. The special thing about ISGs is that they also allow the participation of non-ETSI members. ISG SIM, where SIM stands for Context Information Management, was established in 2017. It's always, ISGs are always for 2 years. So the current extension is until 2025. So we need to ask for another extension quite soon. Have currently about 30 supporting organizations, and our main activity is the evolution of the NGSI context interfaces to NGS ILD, and that's also a bit of the background and where this strange acronym comes from. The story didn't start in ETSI, but in OMA in before 2010, where OMA was defining a suite of different interfaces, and two of these were the context API, then called NGSI 9 and 10, so they were numbered. It's not a version number, it's just the number of that interface with respect to that suite. Then this was taken up by FIWARE, at the time was a large project in Europe on future internet, and that further developed that and defined bindings, which ended up being NGSI version 1 and 2. And FIWARE became from a project to an open source community. Then it was decided, okay, as this is the key interface, really, this should go back into standardization. That's what we're doing now in ETSI, what's called NGS ILD. So high-level goals, it was the evolution of these FIWARE NGSI context interfaces, and we wanted to put the NGSI ILD information model on a solid conceptual grounding, so wanted to apply the property graph model, enable semantic concept definitions, enable linking to existing information, so what we call linked data. And the idea of the API is to give applications a relatively high level of abstraction, enable them to specify what information they require based on this underlying information model, including geographic scoping and the temporal API, and also to support central as well as distributed and federated architecture where information can be arbitrarily distributed. And we'll see why that's important also for our discussion later on. So let's start with the NGS ILD information model. Basically, the assumption of the world of NGS ILD is that the world consists of entities. Entities have a type and an identifier. So you see here a car, a shop, a building, a person, and a unique identifier. In each case, all of these entities can have properties like the speed, location, or address. And they can have relationships, basically. So the person that owns the shop, for example, the camera that's attached to the pole, and so on. So based on having these relationships explicitly, we in the end have a graph. That's the underlying property graph. If we talk about properties and relationships together, we also call that attribute. And not all things are suitable basically to be stored in this way and things. So if you think of a camera, a video stream basically, or maybe a complex 3D model of a building, this graph isn't suitable. But what you can do is basically link and also provide the right meta information for applications to find this, maybe find this camera, and then they would be able to access that stream basically. So you have with this graph also kind of an index structure, can follow relationship and retrieve graph elements from that. Good. The LD in NGIS LD comes from JSON LD because we decided to use not plain JSON, which was used before, but JSON LD. And one thing you can do is basically you have your concept, you can in your instance use nice short names that are human readable and short. But with the predecessor, you had basically the problem, okay, you use these short names, but then maybe somebody else used the same ones, but in a different way. So they were not unique. So what JSON LD does is it says it defines this URI and it defines a mapping. So you define your mapping. You can then still use your short names in your instances, but you also give the mapping basically. And then it means in my document, it means this unique URI. So I have a bit of the best of both worlds. I can still use in my document these short names, and it's relatively easy, but I have still unique URIs behind it. Now let's look at a typical representation of NGIS LD. So here I have an entity, which is a vehicle, has an ID, JSON LD that needs to be a URI. It has a property, the brand name, with the value Mercedes, which happened to be in an accident. So it has a relationship to an object, which is that lamppost, and that was observed at a certain time and provided. So you can put meta information in there. And what you need to attach is at context. So that can either be directly attached to the data, or you can in a header put the URL basically where you can download that context. So for communication. And what's important is basically you have always we are always talking about entities. And in the extreme case, you can handle these attributes for these things separately. So for the same vehicle, you may have in one place stored the ID type and brand name, and somewhere else on the ID type and in accident. And when retrieving them, you want to aggregate this. So that may be relevant later on in the discussion. But I will not go very deeply into the API discussion, but the kind of things you can do is if you know your entity, you can ask a question like what is the location of Sam, Sam being my entity, location being a geo property. What do I need to know? I need to know basically the base URL. I need to know the entity ID. And from the data model, I need to know, okay, there's a location property. Probably security credentials, but that's orthogonal to the core API specification. I don't need to know more complex structures and so on where information may be stored. More interesting maybe is a geographic query. So I can ask which cars are within a geographic area. So here I need to know the type, that the type car exists, and also how to specify that geographic location. I have a place to go and ask that, and as an application, that's I need to know to retrieve this information. From an architecture perspective, this would be the kind of central deployment we often have right now. You have a central broker that stores all the information. You have context producers that create, update, delete the information here, and you have context consumers that query query, or that subscribe and get notifications when there are changes. Can also do temporal based, so get notification every 10 minutes or something like that. But we may also have distributed architectures where information is stored in context sources, so they also implement the query and subscribe notify interface, and so the broker knows how to find that information. They can register what type of information they have. That can be specific. I have for this entity these attributes, or it can be a type-based registration. I have cars maybe in this kind of area. So when I get a request, the broker checks, okay, which sources to have that information. Maybe it also internally has its own information. It will go fetch these things, aggregate these things, and then return them to the context consumer. So and context sources, as they have the same interface, can be full brokers again. So on that basis, you can build a hierarchy of brokers, or even a different kind of things. It doesn't have to be an explicit hierarchy. Okay, so that was basically the general introductory part. I hope I didn't take too much time for it. Are there any immediate clarification questions?
No, I think we're good.
Okay, then I would hand over to Giuseppe. And do you want to share yourself, I assume?
Thank you, Martin. Yes, let's see what happens. So I click
I stop here. Sharing.
If I click here, screen, and at some point, Do you see my screen or do you not see my screen?
Not yet.
Start, stop sharing. It asked me. Nothing happens?
No, not yet.
Boom, I have no clue.
It's the third button. And then in my, if you're using a Mac, you might need to change the permissions.
Yes. Because this is the GCD. Okay, but you should have asked. Okay, so probably it's a silently failing on me. Yeah, you're right. Usually, yes, I need to change the permission. Martin, would you be so kind to
okay,
continue?
I try to continue sharing.
Easier,
then,
probably.
Yes. Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, and I need to...
That's probably faster.
So.
Yeah. You can. Yeah. You can jump to this one. Okay. Just quickly. I'm Giuseppe Tropea from CNIT, which is a consortium of universities in Italy. And my research topic is networks. I joined the NGS ILD group some 7 years ago, I guess. And at some point, we created what's in ETSI parlance is a specialist task force for implementing data integrity in the standard. So we came up with a solution. Okay, of course, starting from one main crucial assumption, just as Martin has highlighted, our information creators are what we call the context providers, and entities pass quite a complex networks of brokers before being related to clients. So basically, of course, the hypothesis here that we want end-to-end integrity. The only entity, the only person, the only thing that is trusted by clients, of course, is the context provider. We cannot assume that clients trust the intermediate brokers. Okay, next slide. Martin, thank you. Starting from these assumptions, we came with a list of basically four main requirements. First one is fairly obvious. The second one, verification of integrity shall be independent of syntactical reordering that may occur when, as I said, serializing entities that pass among peers. One attribute may be serialized by one broker first and then put in second position by another broker when reaching the client. Also, we have several in NGSALE, we have several different output formats. So once we attach verification information, of course, we should take care that this is not stripped out when it passes through the network. Also, as I said, of course, clients would not want to trust intermediate context brokers. So it's fairly obvious set of requirements. Next slide. So the solution we came up with, which is implemented in this specification there, GSSIM 019, relies on mostly on the data integrity work that you guys, of course, are very familiar with. Third reference is exactly the API specification that Martin was mentioning beforehand. A quick note. So this GSSIM 19 is our first release, but an update is in preparation, mainly to align with the updated data integrity versions that, in the meanwhile, have been published. Next slide. Okay, so let me introduce two key terms, the atomic entity and the sealed attribute, and the derivation process that takes us from the atomic entity to the sealed attribute. As you have seen, an entity comprises generally an ID and an array of types at top level, and then a bunch of attributes and or relationships. We define an atomic entity, an entity that comprises only one attribute, and I'll come to this in a second. Then from the atomic entity, we derive a sealed attribute, which is that attribute together with accompanying cryptographic proof and the process to transform one into the other. Next slide. So concerning the atomic entity, as I said, it must be containing just one attribute. Next slide, we try to clarify why. You can jump to the next one, Martin.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So as I said, multiple entity aggregation steps can happen, because if you are the client and you ask for, I don't know, car 123, then maybe broker A contains information about its color, and broker B contains information about its, I don't know, injection date. So basically, when all this info comes to the client, they are, or better say, to the aggregation broker or distribution broker, as we call it, this is aggregated into one entity. Of course, also entities, attributes can be filtered out because of querying, basically because the entities travel throughout the chain of brokers. So The point is that we cannot take the whole NGSILD document representing the entity with all of its attributes and sign all of them together into one big sealed package. This is why we have to, let's say, sign them one by one in what we call the atomic entities. Okay, Martin, let's go to the other one. So the important point here to understand is, though, that when we sign, for instance, the color attribute, being it red, and we want this to be tamper evident, we also need to repackage within the color attribute also the entity ID and the types that this color was referring to. So basically what we do in when we move from the atomic entity to the sealed attribute is that we move this information within the proof. We bound it together with the proof. So we sign that color is red together with the information that color is red in entity, I don't know, car 123 that was of type car. So this is basically our signed package, what we call the sealed attribute. So if we jump to the next slide, it's pretty straightforward. The derivation process, it goes like that. We have an entity with several attributes. So out of that, we create a bunch of atomic entities, one for each attribute that we want to sign. Then we create the NGSILD proof structure and nested it inside each sealed attribute, taking into account, as I just said, that the ID and the types need to go together with the attribute. And then, of course, the value is exactly, and this is the important part, and this is why I said we point to the integrity, W3C integrity standard. It is exactly the proof, field when the proof is created. So we derive the sealed attributes. At this point, Martin, if we skip to the next slide, it's the of course, the reconstruction process is when things get to the client, then it will be more clear in the next slide. Just straight jump to the other one. That's your typical workflow. So context provider generates and signs one atomic entity for each attribute. Each atomic entity is transformed into a sealed attribute through the derivation process we've seen. Then, of course, the provider takes out the original attributes and injects the sealed attributes. At this point, this entity can circulate in the network and can undergo any number of cycles of you know, signing and rearranging attributes throughout the path until it reaches the client. When it reaches the client, it's straightforward. What the client needs to do is basically the reverse, and then validating each atomic entity. The additional step is, of course, that at that point, when I validate the proof, what I have to also check is that basically, the entity ID that was accompanying the proof is matches the one of the entity that I received. So this, do we have another slide, Martin? What was next? Let me. Yes. Okay. So when we started thinking about, so I think it's pretty straightforward what we tried to do, but at the beginning, we were even thinking, but why in the integrity specification, W3C's integrity specification, there's no such a thing as the possibility to map just a subset, of course, to sign just a subset of of the properties of the JSON-LD document, but then, and then to have a map accompanying the document and telling, okay, dear client, you received this JSON-LD, watch out, this, this and that attributes are signed, all the others are not. And we started interacting with these, with your mailing list, actually. This mail is from 2020. So, and we promptly received a bunch of replies. This is from Manu Sporni. He suggested, no, that's the wrong way to do. You have that map. Because then it's a weakness in the security approach, because the client expects the whole document that he receives to be signed. So this is why we took our approach of, you know, making each of those sealed attributes stand on its own. You can, it's basically a standalone, fully conformant document that you can verify by yourself, and then you have the ID and the types inside the sealed attributes that refer to the external entity. So that is the first.
The ID you can check, and for the type it's important we support multi-typing, so we maybe during this aggregation process more types were aggregated, but it was signed with maybe just one of these types, so that's why it's important to keep the original information. And then in that case, okay, that type should still be included in that, but for the atomic entity, you of course have to take only the type with which it was originally signed.
Yep. I think, yeah, we probably didn't show in the examples beforehand that, yeah, that the types can be multiple, so we can have an array of types in there. Okay, so this first part was about signing. So we implemented this solution. Now we have to update it because, okay, the standards have evolved, but mainly the idea stays the same. I don't know, maybe I can go through the ID authentication part. And then if we want, we can have a discussion. This is, not yet a solution. It's much less mature. We haven't published anything yet, but we are now investigating, some important ideas for NGS ALD that's coming from the ID authentication, distributed, identifiers. If we skip to the next slide, this is just basically by how I tried to summarize in my mind the core points about the ID authentication. I think the important thing is that, okay, they are designed to function without the need for a centralized registry or authority, but of course they can even work in a centralized case, so good. We know that the DID resolves to a DID document where we have a public keys authentication method, the service endpoints. But the core point in my mind is that basically the security is strictly related to the public key infrastructure that underpins the DID. So next slide, please. Basically the DID authentication, it boils down to proving that the subject of the DID controls the DID. Everything can change, but in the DID document, but of course the DID has to stay the same. And then there's the DID resolution step that you need to perform in order to authenticate the DID. Next slide. So of course we can have multiple authentication workflows and invoking, for instance, a usual challenger response mechanisms. So this is not the key point. So in my mind, it's what characterizes the trust architecture of the DID is basically the DID method that backs it up, that specific DID. And in the next slide, I tried to group, and I also started this discussion on credentials community group list, grouping the different DID methods based on their trust architectures. From the most simple, which is DID key, and people suggested also DID JWK, which is basically offline. And to my understanding, the subject there can be almost anything. I mean, as long as you're able to create a key pair, you can be a bot, you can be a human, you can be a legal entity. Then there's DID methods based on basically on a key infrastructure, which is the one of the cryptocurrencies, Ethereum, Bitcoin. So it's permissionless, it's global ledger. And in this case, the guarantee is that basically the subject is at least some kind of entity that holds a balance in the network. DID sovereign is interesting because it's a permissioned global ledger, and I understand it has well specified trust governance, and also the possibility to have it through this steward nodes to delegate the trust to other nodes. Question is, what is the subject typically in a DID sovereign network? Is it a legal entity? Is it a human? Is there any guarantee about that? Then I think in EU people are trying also to register another method, which is DID EBSI. In this case, I think it's guaranteed that the identifiers are bound to legal EU entities, and the network is basically the nodes of the network of the key infrastructure are basically owned by EU public bodies. So they say they can support different trust frameworks, but the bottom line, they are owned by, say, governments or public bodies. Then also interesting is the DID web or DNS. In that case, I think I can be sure that the subject of the DID in that case controls some kind of resource on the internet. I mean, they have registered a domain, or they have control over kind of a server on an IP address somewhere on the internet. So I think we have one last slide. And why is this interesting to NGS ILD? Because there's so much work about the data spaces, where basically I think the goal would be to define a trust model where you have a private data space, there's the owner of the data space, and you want to root the trust on the owner of the data space. And also, basically, you probably want this owner to in turn be able to delegate trust to other trusted members of the data space. And of course, members can either be humans or legal entities. So, question: is there a DID method where identifiers are guaranteed to be humans? I mean, it's a little bit of a rhetorical question. And I was following also the discussion on the list about the personhood credentials. This is a fairly recent thing. And I think there was also a research paper about it. So things are ongoing. But that, I think, is probably the most interesting discussion there, because, well, humans and nowadays also AIs, right, which can pass. it's a hot topic, and it's interesting, but I think bottom line for NGS-ILD, what would be our goal is to implement this data space, the data space model, where we at least would like to be able to guarantee that what's behind the DID is either a legal entity or, more difficult, I understand, or a human. I think that's all on my side. Thank you for your attention. And if you have questions, or we can discuss.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the presentation. And by the way, we do have, I did invite the author, the person who credentials, to actually talk about it on November 12th. So if you're interested, make sure to mark that date on your calendar. I have also been trying to get the guys at the WorldCoin to talk about their project, which is also trying to tie credentials to basically authenticated humans, right? And using iris scanners, plus some cryptocurrencies, which I know some people probably don't like as much, but so far still haven't got them to agree to present it here, but yeah, those conversations are definitely interesting, and we'll continue those conversations here.
Sorry, Harrison, when you did say November 12th.
Yeah, November 12th, we will have the Stephen, Zoe, and Shrey, the main authors, to talk about personhood credentials. Yeah.
Okay, great. But do you think we or I could join here freely? Or because this I quite didn't understand whether it's open or the calls are open for everybody, or how does it work?
Yes. Yeah, so it's all free. You can just join via that public link. We also send out the transcriptions and video recordings, so you can also watch it afterwards if you're on the mailing list.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Right. Great. That's interesting. Okay, thanks for letting us know.
Cool. Questions? By the way, I have one clarification question. So, how are NGSILD being used in the productions today, right? Like, who are the clients? Like, who are using it, and then what's their use case?
Yeah. So I think one key. So I think the FIWARE context is where it's used most, but not only. And I think smart cities overall are the main users, but it can also be used in other domains, or is used to a lesser degree. But I think in smart cities, it's already quite commonly used in Europe, but also in Japan and in Korea. They did their own project. In India, they are using it partially together with some of their own standards. So they did their own implementation and partly used NGSILD. So that's about the usage.
So it's mostly governments, basically.
Yeah, but not just, yeah.
Got it. And then, so the next clarification question is, why do you need to federate from different context providers? I mean, for example, if you're a government, you probably have a system of record, right? Like, that's central. So why do you need to have multiple context providers, and then you have to autonomize the entities and then aggregate it? Like, why do you need to do that?
So why do you want a federated system? Because you have different units. Even within the city, you have different departments that may only want to partially share. And then if you go further, you may have counties, states, whatever, and you may also have private operators. So maybe if you're looking at parking spaces and you want that for different areas that comprise different cities and communities, then these may want to partially share their data, their parking spaces, but not necessarily everything. And in such a case, it makes sense to federate that. Don't want necessarily to have one single owner that controls all the data.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, because I was assuming that if you're a government entity, you probably have all in your centralized database. So got it. Thank you. And then the point of the signing mainly for data integrity purposes, because we're talking about signing the data and things like that, just to make sure that the data integrity is good and then it's not being tampered with, that kind of thing.
Yep. That's absolutely the goal. Yes. Because maybe you have a sensor that, I don't know, measures pollution in streets of the city, and you want to be sure that, I don't know, either measurements come from a certified hardware maker, or afterwards that they are certified by the city. I don't know, you as a citizen may want to be able to verify that, and that they have not been tampered with by some malicious intermediate broker or relay node in between, I would say.
Got it.
If I want to depict a typical, your typical use case, of course.
Got it. All right, any questions from the audience? And then one more question. Sorry. When we're talking about the signature, so the signature is from the context providers, right? It's not, does the broker actually sign the document once they aggregate all the contexts together, or the signature is only from the context providers?
Yeah, that's the main point. The signature is only from the provider, because basically you don't trust the broker. You don't want to trust the broker. So, of course, you could add a second layer, which, because in that case, if the broker, for instance, if the distribution broker, before relaying the package to you, aggregates everything and then signs it on its own, then it basically vouches that, well, yes, I am the guy who is aggregating this. You can hold me responsible for this aggregation step. But I'm not responsible for the value that, so if the pollution value is 25 or 27, it was not me, who did that. It's the original provider of the data. So, yeah. You know, it's an additional layer of it's basically, it's a different meaning.
So we came to the conclusion in the end that for us on the attribute level, it made most sense. Also, if we send whole entities in FIWARE, sometimes we have a posteriori access control check, so you might filter on the entity later on. So the broker may return an entity with all sorts of attributes, and then later on it's there's a PEP that decides, okay, that attribute shall not go out, and filters it out. So then it would break the signed entity. So such use cases may also be there, and then in these cases it doesn't make sense to sign whole entities.
Got it. What about the registry, like the registry of different identifiers, and then also the trust framework? Is it the same as brokers, or is it separate? Like basically the broker, the aggregator is separate from the registry, or basically the same? They play the same role, or the same entity play both two roles?
In the sense of identity management and so on, that can be completely separate.
Got it. But in the real world, is it the same entity that plays both roles, the registry and aggregation, or?
Could well be, but what we try is with NGSLD to be able to work in also in different environments, basically. So we don't want to make just one single assumption. So what we are also looking at now in our security is, okay, we look at different scenarios and basically want to give people an idea. If this is your scenario, maybe you choose this set of technologies, and if you have a different one, you choose another. We're currently discussing the use of NGSLD in data spaces, which is a quite hot topic, at least in Europe. And there the IDs play an important role in this underlying idea that you don't have central entities controlling this. So that's why, well, one of the reasons why we said, okay, it's also for us makes sense to dig a bit deeper into the DID case.
Got it. Thanks. All right, any questions? Let me check the queue. All right, so no further questions. I just want to thank you again, Giuseppe and Martin, for actually taking the time to present here today at W3C CCG. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
So this concludes today's CCG meeting. We'll publish the video, audio, and transcriptions in the next day or two. And then please come back next Tuesday. And next Tuesday, we will have Jeremy and Andreas to talk about BBS signature scheme benchmarks. Thanks. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.